This is the JN Podcast, and I'm Phil Dave. Coming up on this show, actress and Corrie star Maureen Lipman will tell us how she got around 400 people cooking along with her for every mitzvah matters. Eurovision champion for Israel, Gali Ataria, reminisces about the song contest, and I dare say we discuss the competition for this year that never was. And our coronavirus hero will be Dr. Sharon Raymond, who's part of a team behind a wonderful way of helping coronavirus patients get to and from hospital. But before all of that, welcome along to this episode of the JN Podcast. And let's start off, as we plan to start each week here, with a look at your copy of the Jewish News. Joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and features editor Fran Wolfish. Welcome to you both. And Richard, let's glance over the front page first and foremost. Two rather big stories on the front page this week. We'll start off, though, with the large headline that reads, Jewish care homes struggle to get tests.
Yes, two stories with implications for almost every reader. At the end of last month, the government actually reassured care homes and residents and workers there that they would be getting swabs so they could test for COVID-19, so they could operate healthily and with limited risk. Jewish Care, which I think operates something in the region of a dozen homes and around 60 other local services nationwide, have told us this week that they received only a small number of tests, so they're struggling. And of course, for people that have got loved ones, it's a completely terrifying time at the moment, because it was on the news only yesterday that government advice for care homes was seen to be inaccurate and sometimes dangerous. So highly topical issue there. The other story, which will affect even more people, is the chief rabbi who has said that the government's plan from around July the 4th to start reopening religious buildings. He doesn't think that these hubs for the community are actually going to open anytime soon. He'll veer on the side of caution. We might face, Phil, the fact that even at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a lot of our synagogues will remain shut.
Which is an extraordinary thought, really. I mean, bearing in mind that for the twice yearly brigade, of which I have to say, this shocks a lot of people. I'm not. I actually am most weeks I attend synagogue. But for the twice yearly brigade, that's going to really throw them off kilter, because actually that's the only time they really have proper interaction with their synagogues. And it's potentially not going to happen this year. Most extraordinary. I mean, Fran, that also, it's just never in our lifetime, I don't think, have we ever seen this sort of disruption to synagogue life, to any sort of life, but synagogue life in particular in this instance.
It's definitely something that, as regular shulgoers ourselves in my family, we are sort of struggling with it a little bit. There does feel a bit of a void, certainly every Shabbat and when a festival comes along, and we're doing our best to do what we can with the kids and to keep up the Jewish life. But yes, I think without that sort of community togetherness on a regular basis, it's very disruptive. And just going back to the chief rabbi as well, I know the Baroness Altman has come out and done a plea on behalf of over 70s. You know, we need to keep older people in mind as well, that they're looking at a much longer lockdown period. Certainly by the time we're able to go out and about, they'll still be at home. And shul for them, for the older community, has always been a sort of a link, a lifeline, as it were, to be able to go out once a week at least and see people and be part of a community. So I think we have to keep in mind that this is affecting lots of people in lots of different ways, whether you're part of a family or have young children or you're older. Not having the synagogues open has had a massive impact on all of us.
Yeah, we're going to be marking Mental Health Awareness Week next week with a very special issue, which I'm quite looking forward to. We've been working on that from today. And mental health is directly connected to social lives, well-being, and synagogues particularly. They're heartbeats of our daily lives, aren't they? From everything from kaluki to mourning our loved ones during this dreadful time. So everything that from serious to frivolous. So not having these places open, I think, really has, it's turned off the lifeblood of our community. I mean, obviously we're finding other ways, just like online as we're speaking now, but nothing ever can replace what we're missing currently.
I do have to say, though, that it is mightily impressive the way that so many different communities, no matter how big or small, have really come together and adapted regardless of anything that's been thrown at them. It is quite amazing. So both those stories, Chief urges caution on synagogues reopening and Jewish care homes struggle to get tests, they are found on the front page of the Jewish News. I have to say, alongside images of Lord Robert Winston and also of Dr. Ellie Cannon wearing masks that, although I understand the meaning is very good, are kind of freaking me out. So I'm now going to turn to page 3, so I don't have to look at them. But all the same, it's a very good meaning. It's a very good reason. And we see headline reads, Jewish weddings are still banned, whatever the JCC might think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a brilliant headline because it sums up what is otherwise a very crazy story. The Jewish Community Council of North London, known as the JCC, earlier this week put out a statement claiming their success at being able to sort of persuade ministers to agree that Orthodox Jewish weddings will be removed from lockdown orders. Of course, the government has sort of flatly rejected this, and unfortunately it is fake news. But I think it just goes to show that it is another, you know, it shows the danger of having stories like this out there. There will be people who read that and think, oh, wow, now, you know, that's true and that's correct and accurate. And they'll think that Orthodox weddings can go ahead. And of course, we've seen just over the past few weeks, there's one very sort of well-known case which made all the nationals of a wedding taking place in Golders Green, which of course was illegal. And I think we have to sort of bear in mind that we are under lockdown and we do need to protect ourselves, and weddings are absolutely not allowed at this time. So any group claiming that they can be is just, it's not only ridiculous, it's wholly dangerous.
Apart from anything, what strikes me about this is that there will be those who rely on the word of organisations such as the Jewish Community Council, which we have to acknowledge are obviously not here to defend themselves, so we have to be fair to them, but all the same, that they have people who would take their word and only follow their word and wouldn't necessarily look at, no offence, but productions and publications such as the Jewish News, because it's not necessarily in their sphere. They don't necessarily think along picking up a copy of the Jewish News. More for them, I say, but all the same, it means that they wouldn't necessarily see that this is not, strictly speaking, true. And that's what's really disturbing.
It's understandable people want to get on with their lives, but it's deeply, deeply irresponsible to put out information, particularly when you are a voice for a community, which the JCC is. I understand people want to get on with things. I mean, it kind of veers back to the conversation we're having about the chief rabbi and him saying that under his auspices, the United Synagogues perhaps will not open anytime between now and Rosh Hashanah. I mean, what about the more strictly Orthodox communities, those that don't fall under the chief rabbi's auspices? What about liberal and reform movements? Are we going to see a position where United Synagogues, of which there's, 60 or 70 in the country, remain shut, while other synagogues are open and now a vibrant part of Jewish life as they have always been? But United Synagogue members cannot go to synagogue. Unless there's one rule for all, you're going to find that some Jews can go to synagogue in the weeks and months to come. Others are still going to be locked out.
Yeah. Look, well, let's just put it this way, okay? As far as the JCC is concerned, if anyone from there is listening to this, personally, I'd love to have a chat about this. I think that we should get you on the program if you are available to join us. You are most welcome. And I'd also stress that anything we say about this is primarily more out of concern rather than having a go, as I say, at those who aren't here to answer for themselves. Page 25 of the Jewish News this week, we have a rather nice looking feature about Israeli entrant for the Eurovision that never was, and that is Idan Alene. Of course, she was supposed to be representing Israel in this year's song contest, which, of course, has been cancelled. I'm gutted.
Oh, I know, Phil, the highlight of the cultural calendar. You and I were in Israel last year.
This is true, we were. I know people think it's a joke, but actually you and I both have a complete and utter love for Eurovision.
We do. It's at times like this that only you and I and millions of other people across the continent and further afield would say Abba Bina Bonnie Bear to each other, or Diggy Loo, Diggy Lay. And you'd know exactly what I was referring to. But it ain't going to happen because, unfortunately, along with all the other big events, it's had to go online. So they're going to, BBC are doing a show on Saturday. I think they're going to perform all the songs, unfortunately, none of which are actually going to be competing. So we won't actually have a winner. So we won't know who the winner's going to be, but it'll be nice. Once a year, I like to check out on what the Moldovan music industry has been up to in the last 12 months. I'll be quite looking forward to their entry. And hearing the Israeli entry, which is really good this year, far better than last year's. It's kind of up there with Netta. It's a real potential winner. Of course, it would have had to gone through the semi-finals to be really nerdy at this point, so it may not have reached the final. Had it done so, I'd have put a fiver each way on it, I think.
I'm also a Eurovision fan, I think you'll find. I watched it religiously. Every year since I was little, my dad used to listen to Terry Wogan. That was the only way to watch the Eurovision, you know, with the radio commentary and the TV going. And I, for one, am gutted that Eurovision is not happening this year. But one thing I will say about the show on Saturday, Israel will have some participation. Not only will we hear Eden's song, but we also have Netta, who'll be coming on performing her new song, Cuckoo, and also a legend, Gali Atari, singing Hallelujah. So, you know, I mean, it's going to be a show to watch just for that alone, I think.
Tell Fran, Phil, I don't think she knows who our special guest on the podcast is this week.
I think I do.
Make no mistake, coming up on this very programme, I'm so happy to say this, I will be speaking to Eurovision legend Gali Atari later on. So thank you both very much indeed. Unfortunately, that is where we have to leave it for a look at the paper. But do not forget that you can pick up your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday, or even if you're stuck indoors at the moment, the full paper can be viewed on the website, which is jewishnews.co.uk. Fran and Richard, thank you both very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the JN Podcast. Now, this week, around 400 people donned their aprons and chef hats for a virtual cook-along with none other than actress Maureen Lipman. A host of personalities from different backgrounds joined the Coronation Street star as part of Every Mitzvah Matters, an interfaith volunteering scheme organised by the charity Mitzvah Day. And let's find out a little more about it from Evelyn Plummer herself, I suppose. What a treat to say that Maureen Lipman, welcome to the JN Podcast. Thank you so much for speaking to me today.
That's okay. It's my pleasure.
And I suppose the first things too is tell us a little bit about this interactive cookery session that you did. How did it go, first and foremost?
Well, I don't know. People seem to have liked it. I was told there were going to be 200 people watching, which is scary enough. I am a very average cook, and that's spinning it slightly. But I'm a great fan of Laura Marks, who started Mitzvah Day, and I think it's a wonderful idea. And I had actually said to her, I feel a bit selfish, you know, I'm in my nice flat and I can go outside into my little courtyard and watch blackbirds nesting and see the fledglings and all of that. And I don't know, I suppose I'm vulnerable just because I'm over 70, but I don't know how to help other people more than I do. You know, I take the shopping to my partner and stuff like that. But, you know, and she said, well, she said, I'm planning this cooking so that everybody can cook something for somebody else who they wish to say thank you to in some way, or just to give them a bit of a boost.
So who did you want to say thank you to or give a boost to?
Oh, well, I decided that I would give it to Nicu, the Romanian caretaker of the defunct hostel in my terrace.
Good Lord.
And he doesn't speak any English, but he's really nice because when the pterodactyl birds who hover over my car do their business on my car in vast quantities, it's got a white roof, so I don't know, they just poo all over it on a daily basis. And sometimes it's just virtually like a car on croute.
That's a lovely image. Thank you.
I like it myself. Didn't know it was coming out, neither did the birds. Anyway, he comes along with his power hose and he cleans it off for me.
Oh.
And I know that he's living in this place, caretaking it, and that there's only a microwave for him to cook by, and he's looking after his son and stuff like that. So I thought it'd be really nice to take him something Hamisha, home cooked. And because it had to be vegetarian, or because a lot of the people I was talking to on the program who were each making their individual dish were Hindus, Muslims, there was a reverend from a Methodist church, various faiths and creeds, because that's what Laura Marks is now doing with her interfaith charity. And so it had to be vegetarian. And I like the idea of something really cozy and warm to eat at the end of these long days, even though the sun was shining all the time and I was schwitzing over my bean and barley soup.
Ah, well, you've just answered what I was going to ask next, was what was it that you made? And was it everyone made this? I know it was a cook-along, and normally the idea of cook-alongs is that everyone does do the same thing. But of course, there have been various restrictions on some people. You know, some people can't just pop to the shops and buy the ingredients at the moment, say. So was everyone cooking the same thing?
Well, I'm not sure what they were told, but we had a couple of renegades. We had someone who made a chocolate cake and we had someone who made flapjacks. But all in all, what they seemed to do was cook vegetable soup. And I noticed that a lot of them substituted lentils for barley, which was fine. But it's a shame because the barley was absolutely delicious. And basically, you know, most soups begin with sweating onions in a pan, don't they? You sweat onions in a pan with some olive oil. You look like you don't know what I'm talking about.
Actually, on the contrary, I absolutely love making soup myself, so I'm only sorry I didn't join along.
Oh, well, I've got some in the fridge. I've got a bit left, which I kept for myself. So I'll send it over.
Oh, thank you.
And then you just sling in anything you like and a bit of stock. And, you know, I used a bit of marigold powder or something. And
love marigold. Got to love marigold.
Love it, love it. Make sure you don't put the marigold gloves in at the same time.
My grandmother did that once with the fish on Friday night. That's another story, but anyway. She was cutting up the fish and she couldn't understand why when she put her gloves, I'm not joking, when she put her gloves on later that evening and the tips were missing, she couldn't understand where they were, and they were in the fish. So, but anyway, that's another story. But let's talk.
The end of the play where somebody put somebody's ashes in as herbs into
God. Yeah. There's quite the image for you. Now, we need to talk more about you, because there will be some who are concerned. You've already graciously admitted, though I have to say I completely and utterly dispute it, that you are the wrong side of 70 and therefore are isolating. And I have to ask you, how are you getting on with isolation? Are you okay? Are you finding it as mundane as many seem to, or have you got stuff to keep you out of mischief?
Well, frighteningly enough, it's not that difficult, different from resting when you're an actor, you know. I mean, it has gone on quite a long time. But I find I'm lazy enough just to enjoy pottering. I've done all sorts of things. I've done an acrylic painting, and I've relearned how to crochet. I used to crochet a lot at the National Theatre when I was an understudy, sitting there all night making bloody great blankets and things because I couldn't cast off. I've made a toy theatre out of a cardboard box. And every week I do, I've just done it actually. Every week I Zoom twice a week a drama class for my grandchildren who are 8 and 5.
Oh, wow.
So they were a bit frisky this afternoon, so we just did Fizz Buzz. Do you know Fizz Buzz?
I've heard of it, but you may have to remind me and others.
We're a kid. Any multiple of 5, you say fizz, and any multiple of 7, you say buzz. So
yes,
it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, fizz, 6, buzz. And they like
understood.
That. And they just have not learned their lines. There's a lack of professionalism in my children, my grandchildren. So I've said to them, look, either you learn your lines, mate, or we cannot continue with this rehearsal. We've got a bit grand.
Well, luckily, you are enormously professional. And speaking of which, it has to be said that Coronation Street has been reborn, as far as I'm concerned, since you went back into it. But of course, it's not the first time for those avid Corrie fans that you've been in Coronation Street, because you played a different character in the early noughties, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, it was 2003, I think. I certainly Jack was still alive because he was thrilled to bits because he wrote the first ones, of course. Episode 13 he wrote, not onwards. And we were, I came back to rescue The Rover's Return when Julie Goodyear had problems with the scheduling. So they brought me in and I took over The Rover's Return for 2 weeks, and then it went rather well and Julie Goodyear came back. But anyway, this time, Evelyn's a good character. She's a baddie, and it's always fun to play a baddie.
Oh, but she's a baddie we love to love.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, all the people in sitcoms who are baddies do very well, you know, whether it's Warren Mitchell in Till Death Do Us Part or the dad in The Royal Family or Hyacinth Bucket, they're all basically saying stuff that we wish we could say, but we don't because we're too well-mannered. And she is, you know, if you're looking for a heart of gold under a crusty exterior, don't hold your breath, is all I'd say.
But of course, it's since the lovely Blanche left our screens that we've been missing that kind of character from Corrie. And it's just terrific the fact that you have brought that back to life in this, in the form of Evelyn. It's terrific. How is it going as far as Corrie is concerned? Because obviously with isolating and with the, we've heard about the delays to the production of Corrie, and they're hoping to start up based, I think, on quite a similar model, I believe, to what they're doing with Neighbours in Australia. I'm not quite sure how it works. But anyway, what's your understanding of how filming on Corrie will resume?
I think they're going to have less storyline. They're going to concentrate on a narrower panel of actors, so it'll be a bit like it is now with the domestic abuse story. You know, you'll see less people each week, and there'll be less episodes each week, and one camera crew will work on one story and another, and we will never meet. How they'll do the makeup, I don't know. Long garden shears, I suppose. We're all going to come out of this looking like cavemen, aren't we? And as far as I think, they're planning to start again in June, but I don't know whether they'll bring the oldies back. So, I mean, I had a word with the producer last week online, and I said, you know, don't ditch the oldies, because the oldies are what Corrie is about.
Oh, that's for sure.
Otherwise, you might as well call yourself Hollyoaks.
Oh, dear.
And he said, oh, no, we've no intention of doing that. I said, so I said, why don't you just let me and Roy sit in a garden somewhere and have a conversation about Donald Trump's hair? Because David Nielsen lives in, you know, in Hampstead. So, you know, we just sit in a park. It could be anywhere. And just talk.
Clever.
We can do that. Film it on a what's it, selfie. You know?
Or of course, the beauty of something like Zoom, as we're speaking over at the moment, is you can create virtual backdrops. So you could actually be in the Rover's Return for all intents and purposes.
Well, of course.
Now, I do have to ask you very quickly, because we're sort of out of time. However, I do want to cram in that we also have to thank you, because you've been very supportive to Jewish News' campaign to get people talking at the start of all of this crisis. And I understand that you've actually sort of personally got involved by phoning some of the readers who may have otherwise found themselves on their own, which is marvellous of you.
Well, I think Esther and I volunteered to do this, but I think I've had two calls, that's all.
Well, whatever it is, it's two more than they may have otherwise had. So from Jewish News to you, thank you very much indeed. And I say thank you very much indeed, Maureen Lipman, for speaking to us on the JM podcast today. And just thank you for being you. You are, without doubt, a bit of a living legend, really. So we're thankful to you. So thank you very much.
A legend or a legend.
It's whatever you want it to be, but I'll go with legend.
Okay, bye, Phil. Thanks.
This is the JN podcast. Now, if you're like me, then you'll be amongst thousands of people who are disappointed that the Eurovision Song Contest, which should have been held on Saturday the 16th of May, has been cancelled due to the outbreak of COVID-19. But that doesn't mean that we can't get into the Eurovision spirit of things. Oh no, because joining me now, I'm honoured to say, is Gali Attari, who, along with Milk and Honey, won the Eurovision Song Contest back in 1979, to which I say impossible, because I don't believe it was that long ago, with, of course, the song Hallelujah. And I'm so pleased that, Gali, you joined me now. Gali, hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Hi. Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this. Seriously, I'm telling you, everyone at the JN is besides themselves that you've agreed to speak to us this week. So
really?
Thank you very much indeed. Well, we're excited. No. You are a Eurovision legend,
no sweat.
You
know. No sweat. So,
now, first and foremost, let's go back. Let's go back to, can you believe 1979?
Yeah. 41 years. 41
oh,
years.
It.
Yes, I can believe. I looked myself in the mirror. No, I'm just kidding. I love what I see.
But what are your memories of that time? Can you remember the feeling of going on stage and performing, the nerves maybe?
Wow. First of all, listen, it was amazing to win in your own country, your home. It was very emotional. This winning was very emotional in Jerusalem with all the people in Israel watching. And it was the second year of Eurovision, the second win a year after another, because the year before also Israel won.
Yeah, Izhar Cohen won for 1978, didn't he?
Yeah, 78, yes, yeah. I was worried, like, not more than any other show, I must admit, but I was kind of calm. But in the other hand, I said, oh, 3 minutes. Everything has to be perfect in 3 minutes, even technically. Everything has to really be perfect. And I was worried that I wanted that everything will be perfect. So I was a little, not afraid. I was excited, very much excited.
Well, it certainly paid off, let's put it that way. And now,
of course, yes.
But of course, the question is, how does it feel? No, because there are some songs that come out of Eurovision with a, as it were, legendary status, because they're so memorable that people remember them for years to come. And I believe that Hallelujah is definitely one of them. So how does it feel to be behind one of those legendary songs?
Well, I agree with you, because many other songs are very good, but they are kind of pop music. And this one, Hallelujah, has something more than that. First of all, it's like, I think it approached to each country, each people in each country, and it has the feeling of staying alive, so-called. I was very lucky to sing one of the most great, beloved, successful in the history of Israel. And so out, you know, in Europe and also all around the world. So I'm very glad that I was lucky to take part, a very big part on this one. And it is also very well goes on stage and performing. And it, I feel that this song unites people all over the world. You know that almost every young singer at that time dreamt of representing his country in Eurovision. I was one of them. I can say that one of my dreams came true.
Well, it certainly did. And not only to represent your country, but then to go on and win it for your country as well.
Right, exactly. And, you know, in Jerusalem and in your home. And, you know, this song was translated and sung for more than 400 covers.
400 languages, really?
Yes. Wow. Yes. Many languages. And, you know, sometimes like when they had the chance, that's the word. Okay. So we could be like me and the group in the chart, and like first place could be like a Dutch version or some other German version. They could be together, our version and the language version of this country.
I happen to know that editor Richard Ferrer particularly enjoys the version he has in German. Now, can I ask, be honest, do you watch the Eurovision every year or not always?
I must admit also that I came back watching the Eurovision. I didn't really watch it for few years. I mean, I know what's going on, but I didn't really watch it, you know, like I was before. But the last few years, I have been watching it, yes. Because listen, also every year they ask me here in Israel and sometimes around the world, and I have to know what's going on.
You have to say yes to people like us once in a while.
You see, we're talking now.
Now, I have to ask you, do you ever make contact with the other Israeli winners? Have you got some sort of little WhatsApp group going between all of you or something that you all communicate?
Yeah. First of all, the last Eurovision that was held in Israel last year, I had a number. I sang Hallelujah with the Swedish winner and with Hungarian, his name is Velka. I sang with Elena Ferreira, that also she won the second place after Israel when Netta Barzilai won. And with Conchita, remember Conchita?
Yes, of course. Yep.
So we sang together. And before that, I met a few of them in Europe, in Germany, in all kind of television shows. So they took Eurovision winners or Eurovision participants. And also last December, I was in Holland, in Netherlands. In Netherlands, they had like a pre-Eurovision. And then I met again all the other winners and all the other participants. And it was a very, very nice. And I sang Hallelujah with the MCs that are going now to be the MC of this coming Saturday television show.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've got a couple more things I want to speak to you about, and I'm running out of time. Now, with this regards to this coming Saturday, the 16th of May, what is happening instead? Because you are involved in a production that's going to be instead of Eurovision. So can you tell us a bit about that?
I was invited that Eurovision production along with EBU, the European Broadcasting Union.
Yep.
Estas approached me to sing a Hallelujah with, they're also in Netherlands, children Eurovision singers. So they asked me to sing Hallelujah with children Eurovision singers all over the years. And of course, everyone in his own country. And then they blend it together. And we made the shooting in Jerusalem. It was, 41 years ago after the winning in Jerusalem, in Israel. And it was in the old city. It was so, so, so beautiful in, the Tower of David and the wall. I don't know how they call the gates. All the beautiful of Jerusalem and logo of the Eurovision was on the wall,
Oh, wow.
It was so, so emotional and beautiful and really, really, it's a beautiful city also, So that's what I did. And yeah, we've seen Israel again. Oh. And they are going to connect all of us together to a wonderful clip. And I just got it, the final version, I got it like an hour ago. And it's also with this time, all the coronavirus and everything,
sure,
that the streets are empty. And it's, I think this version of the song with the children in Netherlands, with the empty streets, I think it talks to anybody else in the whole world because of what we've been through together. I mean, all human beings, So
absolutely.
I think it's very, very exciting.
I, for one, am incredibly excited about watching that performance. It sounds amazing. And thank you so much for telling us about it. I have to ask you just before you go, and I'm very, very hopeful that if I ask you really nicely, you'll do this for us. Would you give us the quickest blast of Hallelujah?
In what language?
Oh, you could do it in English, Ivrit, whatever you prefer.
Okay. Hallelujah, la olam, hallelujah, yashiru kulam, hallelujah, sounds of love. Here comes the English. Hallelujah, the sunshine above, hallelujah, the bells will go ringing and dinging from dawn till night, hallelujah.
Bravo. Todaraba, that was fantastic. Thank you so much. Do you know what?
Thank you.
Can't wait to see you back on Eurovision this coming Saturday, the 16th of May. Gali Atari, Eurovision legend. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the JN Podcast.
With pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is the JN Podcast. Now, each week on the show, for as long as the COVID-19 outbreak continues anyway, we're going to meet a different coronavirus hero. And our next guest is most definitely one of them. Dr. Sharon Raymond is part of a group of five mainly Jewish volunteers who have teamed up with a private taxi company in Stamford Hill to transport infected patients to hospital. It's a remarkable crowdfunding campaign, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that we can find out more about it because Dr. Sharon Raymond joins me now. Welcome to the JN Podcast, Dr. Raymond.
Thank you very much for having me, Phil. Thank you.
Now, we absolutely have to start off with, because those with a keen ear, or probably more appropriate, a keen eye, will know that actually you've featured in the Jewish news a couple of times over the past few weeks because because you've been calling initially for home oxygen monitors. Just give us a bit of background on that, first of all. What are they and why are they in short supply?
So, yes, absolutely. So I think since the beginning of this pandemic, it's been clear that we absolutely need these small devices. They just clip on your finger and they give you an idea, or they actually tell you what your oxygen saturation levels are. And this is absolutely crucial because so much of what we're doing now as clinicians is remote assessment of patients. And we know that with COVID as well, there's a risk of what's known as silent hypoxia. So without the patient who may have, who's got suspected COVID knowing, and without the clinician knowing, oxygen levels can drop to a dangerously low level. And these little devices that just clip on the finger will help to detect, whether the oxygen levels are dropping and therefore more urgent or emergency action is required.
And where are we at with that particular campaign?
Yes, there's some exciting developments. We launched on Monday night, we launched the first oxygen saturation probe loan service for the whole of London. And so that means that basically any clinician that feels that their patient needs an oxygen saturation probe, because they're quite difficult to get hold of at the moment, although they're sold it through Amazon and other sort of outlets, the supply chain is very fraught with difficulty because most of these products are coming from China and there's a huge demand. And so the oxygen saturation probe loan service means that you can get a probe to your doorstep within an hour and a half of contacting our hotline, because we've teamed up with Team Rubicon and the Bike Shed, who have a team of about 200 volunteer bikers who can deliver these probes to your doorstep on the recommendation and on the advice and obviously the clinical oversight of a clinician.
Now, it does kind of beg the question, if it's a loan service, it implies that other people have used it. So how does it work on a hygiene front when obviously social distancing is the be-all and end-all at the moment?
So the way it works is that you get a probe delivered on a loan basis. When you've finished using it, so for as long as you need it for your current illness and monitoring, then you get a stamped addressed envelope, kind of a jiffy bag. You pop the probe in when you've finished using it. It will be sent back to the Royal Free Hospital, to the emergency department, and then it will be cleaned appropriately in accordance with strict regulations in relation to infection control. So it will be properly sterilized and cleaned and then ready and checked and then ready for use by the next patient.
Fantastic. Well, now let's have a look at the other project, because you're somewhat busy, as if it's not bad enough that you're helping on the front line dealing with all of the horror stories that we hear about COVID-19. We'll get onto that in just a moment's time. Let's look at this particular CAB project that you are involved in, because I absolutely love this. There are so many people out there who really don't have a clue, especially those who are perhaps alone by themselves, of how they would get to hospital if they require treatment. And you and your team have pretty much answered that for them.
Yeah, so I work in unscheduled care. And from the beginning of this pandemic, it was very clear that there were certain patients who did need to go to hospital to be assessed. Because again, as I said before, a lot of the assessments of patients are done remotely. But we, you know, there are some patients obviously that do need to go either to hospital or to the COVID hot hubs to be assessed face to face by a clinician. And we were struggling a bit because, you know, some people don't have private transport, and therefore it becomes a challenge to work out, you know, if they're well enough to get to hospital to a COVID hot hub by private transport, but they don't have private transport, then it becomes challenging as to, you know, what are the other solutions? Well, it could be a GP home visit, or it could mean, you know, organising a less urgent ambulance. But obviously, there's kind of resource implications there. So I realised very quickly that it would be great to have a COVID kind of cab service with the appropriate protection in place for both the driver and the passenger. And that's, in fact, what's been set up. I put together an operating procedure with the help of another colleague, Dr. Fiona Sim. And so we have an operating procedure in place that keeps the driver safe and the passenger safe. And my charity, which is on the Just Giving page, COVID Crisis Rescue, supplies the cab service with protective gear as well. And that's both for the passenger and for the driver. And we've also funded the insertion of screens into those cabs that are being used for this service, so that passengers and drivers have the peace of mind to know that they can travel for a clinical assessment safely. We're also transporting those that need to go for testing. So that's just another thing to bear in mind. And for those people, for example, the homeless or those who've got limited funds who can't pay for the cab, then that's being covered by the charity, the COVID Crisis Rescue charity, to cover the cost of that. So if you know you're not sort of excluded from using the service if you can't afford it.
Fabulous. Well, let's look a little more at you, because as I say to any of our COVID heroes, that it's all well and good you doing amazing work for others, but obviously looking after oneself is just as important. How are you dealing with the horrors that we're forever hearing about on the news?
I think it's difficult for all of us as clinicians, because obviously we're kind of at the coalface and we're seeing people suffering firsthand. And, you know, our priority really is to do as much as we can to help, really. And you know, that's what all this kind of voluntary work is about. And also, you know, our clinical work. So we've got a lot of support mechanisms in place. I'm on a very supportive group of nearly 200 Jewish female doctors. And we talk, you know, on WhatsApp very regularly. Obviously, everything is anonymous, but just, you know, sharing some of the challenges and how to address them and sharing information about the services that are available. And so these things are extremely, extremely helpful. But I think the best way to cope with the crisis is to identify how you can help and go about doing so if you're able to.
Well, clearly you are, and you're doing wondrous work, and we thank you enormously for it, not just for all that you're doing on the front line, but all that you're doing as well with your additional work. It's absolutely sensational, and you are, without a shadow of a doubt, our coronavirus hero for this week. So Dr. Sharon Raymond, thank you very much indeed, not just for speaking to me, but for everything you're doing to battle away with coronavirus.
That's very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much, Phil. And that challenge goes on. Yeah, we have to do whatever we can, each and every one of us. And I know so many people in the community and further afield are doing everything that they can to help in these difficult times.
Thank you. Wow. Well, there you go. That's it for this episode of the JM Podcast. At this stage, I would like to say thank you to all of our guests, to Maureen Lipman, Gali Attari, Dr. Sharon Raymond, our paper team, Richard Ferrer and Fran Wolfish. And of course, thank you for listening. And we must also remember to thank Justin Cohen, who has produced this episode. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll be able to hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, including a link, by the way, to Dr. Sharon's Just Giving page, then you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you. It's editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.